ready to go. Super excited to have Tiffany Daniels here from the Minnesota Coalition for Racial Equity to join us for our podcast on racism as a public health crisis, sponsored by Blue Cross Blue Shield. So Tiffany, super happy to have you and can't wait to get into the conversation. Even before we started, we were having a podcast without the podcast, right? So got to get all those nuggets in. But why don't you start and just tell us a little bit about you and about the coalition and tell our listeners what's going on.
Yes, will do. So first and foremost, thank you so much, Kelly and Brianna, for having me. And I am so grateful to Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota, who is a member of the Minnesota Business Coalition for Racial Equity, for them amplifying and lifting up and creating this platform. The Minnesota Business Coalition for Racial Equity is a consortium of large corporations and organizations that are either headquartered in Minnesota or have large operations here that work together to advance racial equity through collective impact. The work that we do is really in service of our vision to build a more just and prosperous state with and for Black Minnesotans. And for our members, that really comes to life in driving positive economic outcomes, specifically for Black Minnesotans. And there are a few areas of focus that our members have prioritized. And the first is employment opportunity, which really focuses on how our members can drive higher levels of Black representation inside their organizations. The second is Black business development, thinking about how we can invest in and support a thriving ecosystem of Black entrepreneurs with the ultimate goal of building a procurement pipeline into our member enterprises. And then lastly, community well-being, which we define as advancing just practices in housing, safety, and policing. And that last pillar or focus area, community well-being, is really a nod to our founding. MBCRE was founded in the wake of the murder of George Floyd, which, as we all know, was a public safety tragedy. And it's really important that I think in efforts and initiatives that were born after that horrific incident, that we continue to think about and acknowledge why we were started and continue to lend our social political capital to making sure that that doesn't continue to happen in cities all across America.
You know, when I introduced you, I said Minnesota Coalition. I left the business part out, which is crazy because, to be honest, when I look at the website and I see some powerhouse organizations that are connected to and members of the coalition, and I think to myself, wow, you know, I mean, obviously you mentioned Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota, but so many others, too, that are standing with you and working alongside you. And I think it just speaks volumes because we do need money to make things happen, right? And we need power to make things happen.
You know, Tiffany, I think about just this past weekend, I had the opportunity to join my daughter, who is a kidpreneur, right? And so as we're talking about that business development, the Carlson Foundation had an event at the beautiful American Swedish Institute, right? And as we're leaving, I want to take her through George Floyd Square. And as we get through, I think about that final pillar the most, right? Community well-being. As you think about the founding of MBCRE, right? George Floyd on the backs of that. How do you see the work shifting once now that the dust is kind of settled, right? And it's not as popular to be involved in racial equity work as it was when everyone was going through the motions, if you will, during George Floyd.
Absolutely. And you're right, Brianna, in that there's been a huge shift. And I'd say the shift has happened really twice in the last 3 years. I think the first shift really started to occur as we were all returning back to routine, let's say post-pandemic, once we were all comfortable gathering again, going back into the workplace. And a lot of businesses, large companies especially, I won't even say large companies, but a lot of us were grappling with kind of a macroeconomic environment that was challenged, right? We were talking about record levels of inflation, high cost of goods, challenged supply chains. And from a business perspective, I think a lot of leaders started to shift their focus towards what might be considered more pressing business issues. So that was the first shift. I think the second shift has really happened more recently in the last 90 days or so, as we kind of deal with the SCOTUS decision on affirmative action and the amount of, I'd say, fear driving tactics and, you know, conversation that is being centered on a lot of corporate DEI efforts, right? To really put some leaders and organizations on notice that, you know, there is attention being paid to corporate DEI, and we want to ensure that practices are not discriminatory or unconstitutional in any way. And so I think that focus, that increased focus, that increased almost uncertainty has caused another shift that I'm feeling in the coalition, and I'd say in the business community broadly.
And you see that throughout more than just business, right? We've seen that in education too, where suddenly when we start rewriting history and deciding that a woke culture is a negative, debilitating thing. So we need to ban books, and we need to ban the words diversity, equity, and inclusion, and we need to get rid of DEI offices, and we need to outlaw diversity training. So definitely we're seeing that permeate beyond business in all facets of society. And it is frightening. I mean, as a white woman, for me to say that is probably insulting to you, but it's frightening to me too, to know that there are people out there that are inciting a war against something that is a necessity. And some of that is driven with the fear of a changing demographic in our country.
Yeah, I think the piece of this that is the most surprising to me is, you know, it has been proven, you know, through from multiple consulting firms, lots of data. You know, there is the W.K. Kellogg Foundation and Citigroup and McKinsey have all released reports to talk about the economic impact of racial equity, that this is really something beyond a moral imperative and really one of a business imperative. I was reading a report from Citigroup just recently from 2020 that said that from the year 2000 to the year 2020, that the U.S. GDP lost $16 trillion as a result of discrimination specifically towards Black Americans. That doesn't even take into account other groups that are discriminated against in this country. So it is surprising to me when we start to think about DEI as bad, when what we know to be true is that we all care about growth, we all care about economic opportunity, and this is really about making better business decisions.
I think about the supplier diversity conversation, right? And the aspect of when we look at racism as a public health crisis, the challenge being others, like we said, outside of public health, being able to see how they're uniquely positioned to also aid in the long range goal. As you think about the work of the coalition and how you all are working to expand those opportunities within the enterprise, what do you see as some emerging trends, if you will, emerging needs as far as supplier diversity is concerned? More specifically, thinking about businesses in Minnesota and increasing that price line and those opportunities for them to be viable and get those big contracts.
Yeah. I mean, I think the first thing, and this is a conversation that we have inside of the coalition with our member companies, is getting to a place where we can disaggregate data. A lot of organizations are very comfortable with the term supplier diversity, recognizing that diverse suppliers include a number of types of suppliers. there's women-owned businesses in there. There's, depending on where, you know, there's some businesses that might be headquartered in a rural area in there. There's veteran-owned businesses in there. You know, there are a lot of groups included in supplier diversity. And we have to get to a place where we are looking at how are we supporting different types of businesses based on what their needs are. And in order to understand what their needs are, we have to be able to look at information in an isolated way. And a lot of organizations do not have the capacity or the ability right now to dig that deep or get that granular in supplier diversity information. I think the second thing is evaluating practices. There are, you know, a number of barriers or hurdles that a supplier has to clear before they can offer a product and or service to a large enterprise. In some businesses, there are, you know, revenue goals, there are insurance levels, there are payment terms, there are a lot of kind of common practices that large enterprises use to mitigate their risk and to help them run their business efficiently that don't work for small and or Black-owned businesses. And we have to be able to really dig into what those practices are, understand who they might not serve, and then figure out a way to work around them. But it really starts with that commitment that this is something that you want to do, because in a large enterprise, this is not going to be a light lift. It's going to require resources. It's going to require different types of decision making. It's going to require new processes and procedures. It's going to require work. And that's one of the reasons why, as I go back to the conversation or the question prior about the business case for racial equity, because of the work required in businesses and companies, it's important that this that outcomes, equity-focused outcomes, be tied to growth. Because in a corporation, the things that get resources are the things that drive and generate growth and or return. And we have to get better about creating that link between the two, because if not, then racial equity or DEI initiatives are always going to be the first to be cut, because they are perceived as not necessarily generating a return when that's absolutely not the case.
I love that. Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
No, you go.
I was going to say, I love that you answer into the chat the conversation about disaggregated data, right? And I think about as we get into kind of the nuts and bolts of what it means to stop, to move away from summary data, In your experience with the work of the coalition, have you gained any tangible takeaways regarding kind of the ethical use of disaggregated data, right? And how, as with anything, it's wanting to make sure that you're using data responsibly, but also that you're using it to advance the, and move forward and close those gaps.
Mm-hmm. I have seen organizations be afraid of disaggregated data because we are afraid of what it might suggest about what we're doing or not doing. And that sometimes we are in love with summary data because it tells a rosier picture. It tells the picture that we want to communicate in our beautifully produced impact reports.
And then you also, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and we have to be comfortable facing the truth so that then we can do something about it. And it is that kind of fear or even the, I know what is there, so I don't even want to look under the sheet or look under the covers, that we have to get around. The work of dismantling racism, of driving growth through equitable practices, is hard work, and it must start with telling the truth, and you got to be able to face it. And I think that is the more kind of qualitative aspect, if you will, of data that we don't talk about as much.
I was just going to say, when you talked about the fear of looking under the sheets to see what really is there. I've heard organizational leaders say it would be discriminatory to look at disaggregated data, that then we might be forced to do something different for one population versus another. And we can't do that because it would be unfair. So it's like exposing this whole institutionalized racism and systemic bias that infiltrates everything, and gets back to where we started in the very beginning, where we're talking about that shift, that fearful shift of looking at who we are and what we're doing and feeling like we have to do something about it and knowing that that may be uncomfortable. I don't know if that makes sense.
It does. And I, to that argument, I liken it to running a business and segmenting your consumers. So a little context, I come to this work not being a DEI leader or practitioner, but as a business leader. I am a marketer by trade and I've spent a number of years running hundreds of $1 million in P&Ls at General Mills. And when we are trying to grow a brand or a business, one of the first things that you do is segment who you serve so that you can get really targeted with your messaging so that you can uncover insights about a particular group to be able to really serve their needs and tell a story that is really specific to that particular consumer group. And I think that is a very similar situation here, right? We are suggesting that there are segments of the American population that we want to serve. And we want and need to serve them differently because of the growth opportunity that they represent to our economy and to our businesses. So as a result, you have to do things differently, right? Everybody doesn't get, that's marketing 101. Everything isn't for everybody. And it is amazing to me, though, that we can understand that situation in one kind of scenario and not apply that same principle or that same thinking in another.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think about when we talk about specifically, let's say, working with the American Indian population or small populations of data, how that argument has been weaponized largely as an argument against even exploring what happens to those populations. And so I think about how from that marketing aspect, what we're really still talking about in some ways is actualizing a corporation's ability to measure their impact. And why wouldn't you really want to know how impactful a product, a service, is to a population? And so I want to get into the question that asks, are there any methods or metrics that your coalition uses to measure progress toward racial equity? And how can these measurement strategies maybe be adapted for other sectors, if you will?
Yeah, the first thing that I'd say to that is that whatever you choose to do in an organization, you should measure it, even if it feels small. If there is an initiative or program that you're launching, measure it. Measure how many people are participating, measure how they feel or how they felt before it started versus after. That there is no bad information, but we just gotta, if you launch something, measure it. The other thing that I'd say, and this is one thing that the coalition does, is leverage existing data. That there are a number of entities, especially government entities, that measure a lot of things, right? In Minnesota, our Department of Employment and Economic Opportunity, I think it is, DEED. Sure. Don't quote me on the acronym. Yeah. But they publish a number of reports and data about employment and certain industries. And it's important to leverage what already exists. I've seen organizations, and I even saw this when I was inside corporations, almost be paralyzed by the lack of information. When there is information out there And at some point, you learn what you can, and then you lean in and you iterate, right? Those are principles that any entrepreneur or anybody running a business would borrow from, right? You build your intuition and that informs your conviction. You start to put things out into the world. You test, you get data back because you're measuring it. And then you continue to learn and get better and optimize along the way. And it's kind of that process or that rinse and repeat that we sometimes know should be happening. And again, are comfortable applying it in one sense, but not also comfortable applying it when it comes to community investment or when it comes to racial equity or things that feel more difficult to measure.
So when you start thinking about economic disparities and relate them, and we know that they are related to health issues, cardiovascular health, we saw it with COVID, and you add in race, gender, sexuality as other factors, how do you imagine moving the dial on economic equality or equity, if we want to go there, so that we can have a healthier society and a healthier Black community?
Mm-hmm. I mean, the two big areas that the coalition focuses on is kind of employment opportunity. And the big metric that we use is representation, right? How many Black people are you employing in your organization? Not necessarily are you hiring, right? Because that's a whole different conversation. And we want to make sure that as you hire in a company, that people are kind of being promoted and can advance, right? But how are you retaining, right? And representation kind of takes both of those things into account, both hiring and advancement. And the thinking there is that when you get people into higher paying jobs, that it can start to contribute to addressing or building greater economic or more positive economic outcomes, right? In our case, specifically for Black Minnesotans. The other is, as we think about supporting entrepreneurs, entrepreneurship is another really strong and viable pathway to wealth creation in families. However, it requires a good amount of work to build a business that will generate wealth for a family, mm-hmm. right? And I don't think we talk about that enough, that it's one thing to start a business and it's challenging, right? It is another thing to think about scaling that business so that it can sustain.
Mm-hmm. You know, Tiffany, I think about the emotional tax of entrepreneurship, right? Mm-hmm. When we're talking about that sweat equity that has to be put in. As we do trainings for educators, we're largely talking about how many families from new immigrant populations, historically marginalized communities, are starting a business and not even having the opportunity to talk about scaling because everything is going into the business where they're not paying themselves. They're not able to, right? Because the children are working, just everything. So I think about for our listeners, how can we help them better understand how increased economic equity contributes to better health outcomes, right? So even if we're talking about for entrepreneurs in your work, in your experience, how can you, what would you like to share that can clarify for them how increased economic equity actually mm-hmm. relates to the health outcomes and improving them?
Yeah. And I'll say this in the most candid and transparent way possible. In a lot of communities, and I'll use the Black community as the example that I'll lift up, a lot of what folks are grappling with is kind of forced decisions because of a lack of access and freedom of choice, as I call it, right? And I say this comfortably as, you know, a Black person raised in the inner city of Detroit by a single mom. A lot of what impacted, and I'll even use my mother as an example to illustrate this, a lot of what impacted my mother's health was that constant balancing act that was really stemmed from not earning enough money to sustain a family, right? The stress of robbing Peter to pay Paul, mm-hmm. and the challenges of thinking about, you know, how my mother could position me for the best possible educational outcomes, knowing that income was limited, right? Like a lot of the choices that I think some communities are really grappling with and hard trade-offs that we're forced to make really stem from us not having enough money in the household. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons why economic opportunity is the priority of the Business Coalition. It's not only because these are areas where corporations have an ability to influence the outcomes, but it's also because it's one of the most acute issues where you could really see a shift in circumstances. If we had some serious transformation aimed at economic opportunity and economic outcomes.
Last week, we spoke with, or I don't know if it was last week, Dr. Reggie Edwards. And he shared about his mother working so many jobs that when we think about your third pillar of community well-being, he saw the priorities of working families having the opportunity to attend their children's sports games. And I think about the aging community, right? A working community who has never had the opportunity to enjoy life. They're largely not able to take advantage. Even if they have paid time off, they don't get to settle into a place where they feel comfortable or less stressed to take it. When you think about your unique experiences, the unique experiences of the work that you do, and the pay equity conversation, where do you see that falling within your coalition members? Is that a top priority? Is that something that you're seeing as a leading indicator that we're on the forefront of people really getting what pay equity looks like? Or do you think that we're just at the beginning stages of a pay equity conversation?
Yeah, I think we're at the beginning stages. And we had a conversation with our member companies in 2022 on Black Women's Equal Pay Day that talked about what are some of the practices inside organizations that HR professionals are leveraging or leaning into to help their organization kind of on the path to pay equity. And we ended up producing a one pager for members to kind of take with them that highlighted questions that they could or should ask inside their organizations, data that they could look for, resources that they could leverage, consultants that they could hire to help start the pay equity conversation. You know, we also then related to that is this idea around pay transparency, right? And pay transparency, you know, we've seen from a policy standpoint, it start to grow in kind of popularity and become more a topic, certainly in some more coastal cities. But I think that is, you know, really related to this conversation around pay equity. How can we be very clear about what people will earn in a job, especially as we think about closing that pay gap between certain groups, and namely groups, you know, like Black women who tend to be breadwinners in their families, especially here in the state of Minnesota. And so we need to make sure that we are providing, that employers are providing folks with all of the information needed to make decisions for their families as it relates that, you know, relates to their employment, you know, so that we can continue to think about how we all contribute to economic opportunity.
You know, you hear about the glass ceiling, but the concrete ceiling, that ceiling that keeps people of color from advancing, you were talking a little bit earlier about helping companies think more about how not only you retain, but you promote and encourage the development of your Black employees, your employees of color, how you make opportunities, as you said, transparent, but also available to employees of color. And when you think about the low income families that are trying to survive, people who make under $50,000, who have a financial crisis, but also a stress gap and a stress crisis, often working jobs that are very physically demanding, contributing to all sorts of health problems. And then on top of that, the societal forces and the discrimination that they face, it's not surprising that it feels impossible, but also that it's debilitating to their health and setting themselves up for a life that's shorter, you know? And so I think, how do we help a system that's geared toward not advancing people of color think more deliberately in an equity audit fashion about what they're doing and how they need to do it differently?
You know, Tiffany, did you have something?
No, you go ahead.
I think that what sticks with me the most, right, being raised by a Black woman, a single mother, I think about how we treat the pay equity gap or the issues, the racial disparities that Black women face, as if it's in isolation of them just being Black or woman. We don't think about that intersectionality aspect where Black women are really being hit with a double pay gap. We're being hit with a racial pay gap and we're being hit with a gender pay gap. Can you share a little bit more about the intersectionality aspect and really the double blow that more specifically Black women face as we think about this pay equity conversation?
Yeah. I mean, it's exactly that, right? It's the double-edged sword, if you will, that women of color and Black women face all the time, right? I see the stat down here at the bottom of the screen about a Black woman earning 63 cents to every dollar that a white man earns. And you're right. So some of that is the gender gap that that all women face in the workplace, right? That all women have to grapple with. It's the kind of lack of advancement opportunities or the difference in advancement opportunities that women have to navigate in the workplace. And then it is the kind of compounding issue of all of the stuff, right, that Black women then have to carry around their race into interactions with both men and other women. And it is, I'd say, it's a challenge, right? I think about the mental acrobatics, as I call it, that I've even had to navigate working in a corporate space, right? And how you have to kind of know your audience extremely well, choose your words really wisely. And it is that, I think, kind of not feeling necessarily welcome, right, in a number of circles, right? If the organization or your team is too male or skews really heavily male, you feel a little different and you feel like, oh, I don't quite belong. Or if you're in an organization that is a lot of white women, you still feel like you don't quite belong. And so it's all of that that Black women carry with us all the time that then just adds to what we know from what the data tells us, right? We know about the pay gap. We know about the difference in advancement opportunities. We know that we have only had a few Black women lead Fortune 500 companies as CEOs, right? We know all about these kind of differences in what we'll say opportunity, right? When we know that, you know, talent doesn't discriminate. It's really opportunity that does.
I think that's the t-shirt design, right? When you think about like slogans of the movement and things that we're really hoping to underscore, I think about one thing that you just highlighted. And when I said that there was kind of that double whammy where Black women really are suffering in, from two significant pay gaps, I'm thinking that Black women in organizations are not only being paid less than white males, but then also white women within the organization, right? But I want to underscore the ways that, or elaborate really on how addressing pay disparities really goes above and beyond the monetary concerns, right? We're really talking about the broader issues of fairness and dignity and opportunity for Black women and women from communities that are historically marginalized in the workforce. And I'm wondering if you can share a little bit more about either work that you have been doing in that area or initiatives that you've seen that can largely, like you talked about, I think it was Black Women's Equal Pay Day, right? Really where you're helping to underscore and highlight and amplify some of those unique intersectional issues.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that the coalition launched earlier this year in partnership or in collaboration with an organization called The Partnership is a leadership development program that is specifically for Black mid-level professionals in the state of Minnesota. And so looking to MBCRE member companies to identify their high potential talent to help us build this initial cohort. And one of the conversations that I remember having with a particular member was specifically around some of the gender differences and ensuring that they were elevating women for this opportunity, right? And as you look at certain functions in certain companies, they do still tend to be, some of them can be really male dominated. And this one member organization had just received a deep dive report on the experience that women of color and Black women especially have in the workplace. And so we had to have a very clear and pointed conversation about the importance of them identifying Black women talent to then nominate or recommend for this cohort. And it happens a lot like that, right? Having very small conversations or, you know, coming to those kind of discovering those small aha moments that then build to something transformational. A lot of the work that our companies are engaged in, our member companies are engaged in, and even the work happening here across the region, it seeks to address systemic issues. And that's absolutely right. And systems are made up of people. And people make decisions. And it's important that we are influencing those individual people made and people led decisions on our quest to address systemic racism. It's really the only way.
So what can people do who aren't you? What can other people do?
Well, I think it depends on who you are.
Mm-hmm.
This job, me taking this role was really my form of activism. I took this role in leading the coalition really as an outlet for my own anger after the murder of George Floyd. Mm-hmm. I'm not suggesting that everyone wants to alter their career path for the movement, but if that's your jam, that's your jam. That was the thing that, you know, I chose to do. I think there are leaders who have a responsibility to think about how equity shows up in the work that they do every single day. The sort of transformation that we need in this country and across the globe, specifically for Black communities, is not going to be accomplished with folks doing it off the side of their desk. I'm running an organization and we launched a DEI committee. Mm-hmm. Or I lead a company and we created a DEI task force. This is really about how we are building equity into our growth strategies. It must be a part of how you expect to make money and or how you run your organization day to day. If it's not, then the work won't get done. And so for the folks that are not me or that have are in a role that can inform the priorities and strategies of organizations, then I'd say if equity isn't showing up there, then you're not doing it. For folks that might be, you know, more mid-level in organizations or maybe even just starting out, I'd say start in your sphere of influence. There are decisions that you make in your job that may be big or small. And even if they're small, you start there, right? Identifying practices that isolate or exclude a group of people is not the work of only a handful of folks. It's not only for the people at the very top of the organization. It's for everybody. It's got to permeate every single level and every single decision. And until we're in a place where an entire organization or entire teams are thinking about equity and how they are either adding to the problem or solving the problem, then we are going to perpetually be up against not seeing the progress that we so want and need for communities in this country.
Tiffany, when you talk about a sphere of influence, right, or a sphere of responsibility, I think largely when we've been doing this work, we encounter that mid-level professional who's passionate, but who also isn't privileged enough to lose their employment as a result of the advocacy, the activism, or the movement, right? And so I'm wondering how you've grown to learn how to define a sphere of influence or how others can go about defining their individual or even their organization's sphere of influence and responsibility.
Yeah. And I so appreciate that question, Brianna, because that is where you typically have the greatest scale, right? There are more kind of entry-level or mid-level employees in an organization than anyone else. So that's really where the rubber meets the road. And I have been a mid-level manager in a large enterprise. And so I understand how difficult it is. And I recognize the places where I had decision-making authority and chose to ask the right questions or advocate appropriately. For example, as a mid-level manager, some of them have hiring decisions. You have the ability to hire talent on your team. Think about how you're assessing potential candidates, how and where bias is creeping into that decision-making process. And it's not necessarily on you to fix it all alone, but I challenge you to raise the question in a room of your peers. There are other instances where you run a business. Right. I was running a business at General Mills and was digging into our consumption data, right? Who ate this product, and recognized that over 90% of our consumption was driven by white consumers at a time when demographics in the United States have shifted. Right. 10 years ago, we were saying they are going to shift.
Yeah.
Now it's here. Right. There isn't a business really that can bank its growth just on white people.
Right.
I'm sorry to say.
It's so true.
So if you're interested in growing, then that means you're interested in communities of color. Mm-hmm. And so the recognition that this brand that I was working on, that our consumption was so heavily driven by white consumers, I started asking the question about, well, why not? And what might we do to introduce this product to families and consumers of color? Right? And it was just that line of questioning that then led the team to us building a strategy that was specifically for families of color and grew that business for the first time in a decade.
I love that.
But it's not.
Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead. No, you go.
I love when you share about introducing a new product, right? Mm-hmm. When we talk to organizations or you think about, I've asked them, well, what is our product designed to do? And some will challenge, well, what is it also not designed to do? And just simply being willing to ask the question in really a better brainstorming kind of way, right? Where we assume that everyone expects us to step into the room with the answers. And sometimes it's that person who steps into the room with the question.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, the more, I think the best leaders know that I'm not here to provide the answer. I'm here to ask the question and create the environment where folks feel empowered to go and identify a solution together.
Now, when you say identify a solution together, right, as you're in your marketing brain and you're thinking about launching new products or new services that would appeal to these communities that have historically been marginalized, right? They've largely been out of the conversation around the products that are entering their community. Have you developed any unique strategies or tips for organizations when it comes to those authentic partnerships, right? Leaving the agency still within those communities, but still allowing them to be involved in the decision-making around the products that enter into their communities.
Oh, absolutely. And the process and the way of working at NBCRE is really designed after a new product development process. And it starts with community listening to experts, right? And folks with the lived experience, they are the expert, right? People with the, you know, problem you're trying to solve, if you were talking about this as a new product, those are the folks that understand it better than anyone. And you want to spend time immersing yourself and building empathy. And so that's at the coalition, one thing that we prioritize, community listening. And it's really important as we prioritize community listening that we aren't going out and creating new forums for people to come and share with us. That there are a number of forums that already exist that we need to honor and figure out how we can participate and support without taking over the conversation. There is no lack of information in communities about what they need. Organizations, especially organizations like NBCRE that are, you know, a consortium of corporate folks, we have to be very intentional about positioning ourselves in closer proximity to those voices, because it's not going to happen naturally. So that's one thing, right? Making sure that we are listening to communities, honoring what is already happening, and then starting to identify ways that the business community's resources can be transformative. How can we help? Again, it's not about how can the business community build its own solution to a community challenge or a community issue. How can we help and aid and accelerate the work that is already happening? The work that community has already said is impactful, is important, would really support them in their needs. How might we be helpful, right? Those are the conversations that I have the most often with nonprofit organization leaders or leaders of other initiatives here locally. It's really about how can we help? How can we come alongside what you're doing and throw gasoline on the fire? And that's really been the process of the coalition. And again, it's borrowed a lot from how you might think about new product development if you were running a business or if you were starting a business from scratch.
Awesome. You know, Tiffany, as I think about how we're talking about activating those existing community spaces, I think about this summer, I had the opportunity to go over to Omaha, and they had community days where right in the backyard of a home, we had a concert. And so that was around this initiative that talked about activating the spaces in which we live, the community, and building the community that we want to see, right, from the inside out. And so as you talk about corporations and largely that challenge to not create new forums, right, not create new work for the communities, but rather to find your unique lane and your authentic entry into what they already have going on in their communities. Can you speak a little bit what that looks like, be it sponsorship, be it just showing up and tabling? How can corporations create a tangible way for really authentically partnering with communities to solve these unique issues that we're talking about?
Yeah, I think it starts with understanding what the needs are. The model of NBCRE is a partnership model. We don't exist to build new programming, and we are not resourced to sustain and execute new programming. It's really about how we identify initiatives or organizations that are kind of building momentum, that are Black-centered, and then ideating alongside that organization to identify what might be needed. And I'll give you an example of how this has come to life for us. We recently wrapped a campaign in partnership with First Independence Bank of Twin Cities. First Independence Bank is Minnesota's first minority deposit institution and only one of 144 in the United States. A group of large financial institutions banded together to bring First Independence here to the Twin Cities. It is its first, they launched their first branch outside of Detroit, Michigan. The bank has been around for over 50 years in Detroit and decided that Minnesota was right for strategic expansion. And, you know, as we started to think about opportunities to support Black entrepreneurs and wanting to really get to the root of that challenge through community listening and understanding where members kind of had resources to allocate, we really started to think about this idea of access to capital as a relate as a barrier to for entrepreneurs, and quite frankly for Black homeowners as well, and quickly came up with the idea of a partnership with First Independence. And it started really with a conversation and understanding where First Independence was focused at the moment. Not where we need you to focus. Let's talk about, so we sat down with the senior vice president and regional leader for the bank to understand his priorities and start to brainstorm how the business community might be, resources from the business community might be impactful. And what we landed on was essentially a deposit challenge. The bank was focused on deposit growth because deposits fuel the programs at a bank. We all know that. And First Independence had a number of programs around Black entrepreneurship, Black homeownership, supporting entrepreneurs of color that we wanted to be a part of, kind of fueling, if you will. So we launched a challenge with the goal of driving $1 million in deposits at First Independence. And the campaign closed on Juneteenth, on June 19th this year. It ran for about 4 months and we drove $3.2 million in deposits at First Independence. But it started not with us going to the bank and saying, we want to do this for you, but really saying, we want to be supportive of what you're building. What do you need? And let's collaborate on what a solution might look like.
That's amazing. I mean, it was a whole movement, really. And in the end, it's full circle when you start thinking about the kind of change you can make.
Mm-hmm. I think for me, it highlights, you see these things in the media sometimes, but you don't really understand the behind the scenes actions, the, mm-hmm. the questions, the things that started as a question of one that really propelled the movement, right? And an opportunity to say, we're going to try for the ceiling and not the floor. They might need $1 million, but we were able to provide 3 million, right? Three mm-hmm. times that initial goal. And so I think as we're thinking about our listeners who are practitioners, who are students who will one day join these movements, it's not just being willing to ask the question. I think we always talk about universal inclusion, right? Looking at the most marginalized person within any space and working your way outward. And that's where you find those opportunities that might seem minute, right? Some would say it's just one bank. It's just a small chain. They only have, you know, this many. And I've heard that language where you say they're just a small business or they only have one location. And you look at RFPs, you look at things and you say, how are they ever to grow? If no one takes the chance, the risk, creates that opportunity. How can a small business become a Fortune 500, right? We don't have dollars in the community long enough for them to do so. What are the opportunities that we can uniquely support what they're already doing? And I think that if each of us can take a piece of that and just say, what is already happening in our communities? What can I support? Everybody wants to be the CEO, the CFO, the boss of a movement. And it's, what if your talent, your gifts are actually to be lended to that movement in a different way, in a different capacity, under a different sphere of influence?
For sure. Thank you for saying that, Brianna, because it really makes me think about a couple of the really big lessons that I've learned in leading in BCRE. And the first is really that this is a game of inches. I came into this role as a transformative thinker, right? You know, I thought I was some hotshot coming from the private sector that loved big ideas, that loved to kind of tear it down and build it from the ground up. And I wanted, you know, the change to be transformative and almost immediate. And I have learned that it's really exactly what you describe. It's multiple players. It's an entire ecosystem, everyone doing a little bit, right? And when I say a little bit, I don't mean the minimum that you can do. I mean, everyone doing what might be in scope to be their maximum. However, that might be just a few inches, right? That we are not going to wake up tomorrow and racial equity be achieved. And that might sound naive to folks that I even had that expectation, or that I felt like we could really see some significant progress. And I still certainly have that goal, but I am realizing more and more that this is really about every single player doing what they can. The other lesson that I've learned is that the type of transformation that we need in this country, no single organization, leader, or entity, or even sector can achieve it alone. That it is really going to require collaboration. And that's the spirit of the Minnesota Business Coalition for Racial Equity. It's about leveraging the power and scale of all of these companies together. It does not negate the work that each organization might be doing on its own. Please continue that work and bring those ideas to the table so that you can join arms with a company that's half your size or a company that's double your size and see what we might achieve together, right? So it's those two things that, you know, this being a game of inches and really we must work together, that really stand out to me as some of the biggest lessons that I'll take with me even after my time as managing director is complete.
Well, we talked a lot about change and how to make change and from lots of different perspectives. And at the very beginning of the conversation, you were talking about the shifts that you've seen during this work. And one of them being driven by the affirmative action decision. And so as you look forward, while you have so many irons in the fire in terms of making change as a transformative leader, as you look forward to the legislative process, and as you reflect back on the work that you did on the Crown Act, what are some things that you see, that you forecast, that you know that there can be a movement on to aid in the change that needs to be made?
Yes. I'm so glad that you mentioned the Crown Act because the coalition's participation in passing the Crown Act in the state of Minnesota to ban race-based hair discrimination remains probably one of my proudest moments. And I think one of the clearest examples of the power of having the voice of business kind of included in policy making and policy advancement. The Crown Act, our involvement in the Crown Act was really a collaboration with one of our members, Children's Minnesota. The conversation started, you know, with understanding how might our members work together to help create more inclusive workplaces? And the Crown Act had been building some momentum for a few years. The bill had been introduced here in the state of Minnesota a few years prior, but had not moved past the House. We had started having community conversations with organizations that were already advocating for the Crown Act, like the Black Women's Wealth Alliance, and then started to understand this is an area where the voice of the employer might really be helpful and transformative. And that's how, you know, we like to approach policy decisions and policy priorities. It's really about where are the places where our voice, our collective voice, is going to be differential and add to the conversation versus be a distractor. There are some places when, you know, big business shows up, it can be a distraction. And there are others where we can really add a point of view and perspective to the conversation that hadn't been there previously. And the Crown Act is a great example of that. I mentioned it was a collaboration with Children's Minnesota, who had prioritized the Crown Act to better serve all of their patients. And we have data that says that we need more inclusive workplaces, that more inclusive workplaces lead to higher levels of innovation. Higher levels of innovation tend to lead to stronger financial performance. So it was a very kind of clear line of reasoning as to why businesses might care about the Crown Act. I'd say personally, it was really fulfilling for me as a Black woman to have an opportunity to go and testify in a Senate hearing and talk about wearing braids in a corporate space for the very first time. And it was really, I think, an example of the importance of having diverse voices at the table, creating environments where folks feel comfortable being vulnerable and open about their story, because it can sometimes lend credibility to a topic. And this was an example of how my own personal experience kind of lent credibility to an area where the coalition was showing up from a policy perspective.
You know, Kelly, the Crown Act is half my jam, even in ways that it's so funny that it took for us speaking with you today for me to see the merger of the world, right? The corporate side of the Crown Act conversation. I largely was able to join it from the educator side, right? A part of the work that we do as educators, but we talk a lot about that lived experience and that silence killer of feeling like my hair is unprofessional and not really understanding what that looked like, what it means to not be embracing your natural form, to have to maintain, upkeep, and look like something else. And my daughter, when she was four, I think it would be like December of 2019, maybe, when we were initially as a state having some of those conversations, is largely when we published our first book with our natural hair ABCs. And moving into this dialogue, I look at it from that lens of, oh, world it will be when she's in the workplace and she's affirmed for who she is, what she looks like in her natural form. And I've enjoyed writing children's books and having that conversation from that children's lens. But as a woman, I think the child inside of me often cries, right? Just thinking about the plucking, the pulling, the lack of acceptance on a daily basis. And what carries me, I think, when I initially used to do this work, I had a pressure to straighten my hair before presenting, right? Or I would get a sew-in and I would never stop feeling for my tracks, right? It was like this thing of me being like, my tracks are showing. And I didn't realize until going on that Crown Act journey across the tiers, across the levels of women who testified, right? We talk about Black Women Wealth Alliance, looking at efforts like the B Marketplace and things that came out of the Crown Act, we've had beautiful change. And to speak with you today, to have the opportunity to see the things that we don't understand that are the seats at the table that really have been a driving force for the change that we've seen, not just in our nation, but obviously Minnesota, right? And this podcast today was sponsored by Blue Cross Blue Shield Minnesota, On that topic of racism as a public health crisis, with the understanding that they're a one state blue plan, right? And they're largely looking to give back. And this conversation was just one of those ways. And I appreciate you being here to share that with us today about the Crown Act.
Thank you.
Everything.
Thank you for having me.
And for hopefully inciting and inspiring others to figure out, as you said, to find their sphere of influence and to think about what they can do in the jobs that they're in and the communities that they're in and how they can make a difference. We do appreciate you being here.
Well, I appreciate the platform. I appreciate the opportunity to share a little bit about what the coalition is up to and a little bit about my own personal journey in hopes that it might inspire other folks and just move us along in this game of inches.
That the game of inches is literally, I think, when we think about how we have to shift this title, today's discussion, we really underscored really the profound truth that equity is indeed a game of inches, right? It's a slow, methodical journey marked by these incremental steps, but it's in those inches that real change happens. And so our guest today, Tiffany Daniels, Managing Director of MCBRE, has illuminated this path for us, right? You've talked about the health equity aspect in ways that we don't always see our unique sphere of influence, sphere of reference, and the ways that lived experience, you know, even coming from Detroit, right? Like thinking about how your hometown shaped change in this new place that you built and were able to call home. And I think that equity is a holistic game of inches, right? It's looking at the basic needs that we all have and seeing how we're each uniquely positioned within this game to make movements, to keep the momentum going and to ensure that this game of inches continues to make gains.
Absolutely.